Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll talk with Jeffrey Nichols. He is editor of the Arches Reader. This is part of the National Park Readers series. It's an anthology of writing about Arches National Park and the surrounding area. The selections range from creative nonfiction to short fiction to poetry to amateur versions of scientific reports, much else in the book, photographs as well. And Jeffrey Nichols is a professor of history at Westminster University. He's author of Prostitutes, Polygamy, and Power, and co-editor of Playing with Shadows, Voices of Dissent in the Mormon West. Jeffrey Nichols, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for asking me.
Some great writing in this, and of course we'll learn much more about Arches than at least I knew before. This iconic park. I was reading from your biography at Westminster University's site, just, you know, apropos of nothing here, but you were an anti-submarine officer in the Navy?
I was in Ronald Reagan's Navy in the early 1980s, actually through 1992. But yeah, I was a backseat guy. I was a naval flight officer on board a P-3 Charlie Maud, chasing Soviet submarines around the Pacific. And just as I got qualified to do that, Mikhail Gorbachev came to power and withdrew all the ballistic submarines, and we had to change our mission.
Okay, yeah. And then you came out to Utah because of ROTC. Am I reading that correct?
Yes, that was my shore tour.
Yeah, yeah.
Teaching at the University of Utah.
Right. So you have a long connection with Arches, and you write that I guess your first instance of seeing Arches was a vacation with your family in 1972 that made an impression on you, I guess.
Yeah, we didn't actually go to Arches in 72, but we went to Mesa Verde. So as the first I saw what I think of as the high desert.
Yeah, yeah. Out to Salt Lake City in 1989, and then Arches became a regular stop.
Indeed. Yeah, my wife and I, we built a house at Pack Creek Ranch, just south of Moab, that we've been there. We've had that place for 21 years now.
So you had Ken and Jane Slide as neighbors, you say.
Indeed. And unfortunately, we lost Jane just a couple of months ago. But Ken's still a neighbor.
Yeah, wow. How's he doing?
He's okay. I saw him on Sunday. He's 96.
Right. Yeah. An icon. Also Edward Abbey's in-laws, at least for a time in that area.
Indeed. Yes. His final in-laws. Yeah. As we saw.
His final in-laws.
Yeah. They lived there at Pack Creek as well. They had a place there. Clark Abbey, his widow, owned a lot there for years. She didn't build on it. So.
Yeah. I just want to read this paragraph from your introduction. We'll get into talking about geology later, but that's a big part of this park. Geology is the star attraction in many national parks, but Arches National Park reveals erosional wonders like no other place on Earth. There's something thrilling and slightly unsettling about a big orange rock with a hole in its middle, or a ribbon of stone flung like spider's thread from one rock face to another. First, your eyes might not accept that they are seeing the blue sky or snow-capped mountains framed by stone. There are so many stony holes here of so many shapes and sizes that people spend years hunting unrecorded arches. You want to say that still unrecorded arches, you put it around 2,000, but that number might change.
It might, and of course some of that is definitional. There is no sort of standard, you know, what's an arch versus just a small hole, and people go back and forth on that. Mm-hmm. So.
Now this park, a lot of visitors come and don't go more than, I don't know, how you see the main attractions. That's a lot of visitors. But you say the best experiences come on foot, sometimes on the river as well.
Yeah, I think so. And that doesn't, Arches is perhaps more of a more of an auto park than a lot of parks. But it's not that unusual in any national park for people not to get more than 200 yards away from their cars. But there's a lot to see. There's a lot to see in the backcountry and the surrounding area, certainly.
Of course, you'd have to talk about Moab when you're talking about the park. You write that this may be one of the most complete identifications between Gateway Town and a national park anywhere in the country. If you go to Arches, you're probably going to end up in Moab.
Yeah, I think so. And often vice versa, but not always. Yeah, there's only sort of one gateway town. Some of the other bigger parks have two or three. But yeah, Moab and Arches have certainly been they are tightly linked. And part of that is because there's only one campground in Arches. It's not that big. So lots and lots of people stay in hotels, motels in Moab, and then visit the park.
Now, you begin the book appropriately with Edward Abbey. Many of his writings are about arches and the surrounding areas. And a lot of the themes, right, that'll come about most public lands come up here. Abbey mourned what he called industrial tourism.
Yes, which has certainly, he's writing that in the 1950s, when it was barely getting started. So he was there very much at a time of, as he would call it, solitude, even though as always he sort of shaped the story. He was there with his wife and a child, who he kind of cuts out of that book. Yeah, Abbey has been. He so dominates the story of Arches that it was somewhat difficult to find other writers about it. I think he was so closely associated with it. He wrote so memorably, so eloquently, so well about it, that I think it almost there's an Abbey shadow over the park in some ways when it comes to writers.
You also include appropriately Amy Irvine's response to she wrote her book responding chapter by chapter to Desert Solitaire, right?
Indeed. Yeah,
Yeah,
and she,
go
yeah,
ahead.
sort of challenging, and in some ways kind of challenging Abbey refers to it as Abbey's country. Certainly the man, he was not lacking in ego, shall we say. But I always thought that was sort of a throwaway line. Amy Irvine is suggesting, so hey, my folks have been here for generations. I have as good a claim to this as anyone. And certainly, I admire Abbey's writing. He is, how should we phrase this? He's not the most gender inclusive writer that ever put pen to paper.
Yeah, certainly. And Amy Irvine tackles that pretty directly
Indeed.
in her response. She talks about, the notion of solitude, what it was in Abbey's time and what it is now.
Yeah, it's difficult. It is still possible to achieve solitude, I think. But it takes work, particularly in the busy season in Arches. Arches is it's a relatively small park. It gets lots and lots of visitors. It's got the one main road with some, branch roads. It gets full. So it is possible to walk into the backcountry, but it's not easy.
Now, there's an irony with Abbey. He decried industrial tourism, but his writings on this area helped to popularize it.
Yeah, and I think he was well aware of that. He writes sort of towards the end of Desert Solitaire, don't try to come and see the places that I'm describing here because they're gone, which is not quite true. And again, he's writing that in the 50s, although the book was published in the 60s. But that's 50 years ago, 60 years ago. Yeah, it's one of the great ironies that he describes it so well. whole lot of people show up clutching a copy of Desert Solitaire, including perhaps most significantly for my collection, Jim Stiles. Stiles, I would argue, is the other person perhaps most associated with it. I mean, his name comes up over and over again in other people's stories.
And you include him in this anthology, appropriately enough. Just one more thing on Amy Irvine. She kind of a funny line. She says that, you know, she mentions a walk in the park, but she's covered her tracks, hasn't left a GPS. And then she's saying to Abby, if I did that, then hordes of people would come to that exact location because of the internet. And she said, internet, long story. he's
exactly.
Abby's pre-internet. Yeah.
Ooh, he would hate the internet.
Yeah. So the first section in the book is a place of rainbows. You talk about the geology. You say a proper scale of time in arches is geological rather than biological. This is millions of years, right?
Indeed. Indeed. I'm a terrible geologist. It doesn't stick in my head. But yeah, this is a place that, even though erosion is constant and erosion is always happening, the place doesn't look that much different than it looked 10,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago.
Mm. And I learned this from your book. You say it's water and freeze-thaw cycles are more influential in the geology, in the erosion, than wind.
Yes, I think that's I think that's true. That seems to be the accepted version now. And I had to include that my favorite story of being on a river trip and two really qualified and preeminent people getting in an argument about that, and one closing off the argument by just kind of snapping, wind don't do, let's say, crap.
You have what you describe is, I'll just read this. Following article appears to be the first scientific notice of the sandstone formation in the Arches region. Arthur Winslow's A Natural Bridge in Utah, 1898. 1898 seems kind of late.
Exactly. I think this is something about this place, even though it seems it is, easy to access now, relatively easy to access now, from Salt Lake, wherever, a number of places in the West. It wasn't on the way to someplace else. It wasn't a place that people wrote about, spent time in. Certainly indigenous people did, but there's not a whole lot of evidence that large numbers of indigenous folks lived there either. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't really a place people saw. And even some of the early accounts that I include, relatively early, B.W. Allred talking about his father and uncle running a stage line through there. He doesn't say a word about formations. He doesn't say a word about arches or buttes or anything. And I think that was, Moab itself is a relatively recent town. It was only really settled in the 1870s, 1880s. And some people knew about the arches formations, but it really wasn't, you know, it didn't become known to the world until the 1920s.
Mm-hmm. You say some of the earliest European explorers, you know, Spanish explorers, the fur traders, many of them didn't leave a record. They didn't write about it.
Yeah, we don't, we have no definitive evidence that any of the Spanish explorers, would-be conquistadores, found their way in there. They made their way, we know, to the banks of the Colorado. But they didn't leave an account of going further. We sort of have, you know, we've got Denis Julien leaving an inscription on the base of an arch in arches, but he's a mysterious guy. We don't know what he thought of it. We don't know what he saw. So.
Mm. Let me back up and mention the ancestral Puebloans, as you do. Yeah. They did leave a record, right?
Yeah, there's quite a number. And there's more recent one of Numic folks, probably Utes, which we can tell because they depict people on horseback. But yes, there's a fair number of petroglyphs, especially throughout the park.
If you just joined us, you're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest is Jeffrey Nichols. He's a professor at Westminster University and editor of the Arches Reader. This is a part of the National Park Readers series. We'll have more following a brief break. You're listening to Access Utah. Tom Williams here. My guest is Jeffrey Nichols, who's editor of the Arches Reader. Now, in many areas of Utah, there's you have to mention the members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They will have founded a town, but Brigham Young did send out a mission to this general area. It didn't last long.
Yeah, you know, he called a number of missions, particularly in the 1850s, to different places, as far as California, as far as San Diego area. And in 1855, he called a mission to what they referred to at the time as the Elk Mountains. So it was in the, Moab or Spanish Valley, as they would have called it then. And it only lasted the season. They got driven out by the fall of 1855 by indigenous people.
The town that so Moab was founded, I guess, by what, ranchers? Is that what Moab was founded by?
Yeah, it was people who were coming mostly apparently from kind of central Utah, a little further north. And coming looking for good grazing land. So yes, they saw that valley, and certainly the water as always. It's always been the Moab Spanish Valley is it's a passageway. It's a pathway north to south, and it struck them as a pretty good place to run cattle, and eventually sheep.
One of the ranchers was an African American named William Grandstaff. He had his name on a canyon, inappropriate name that's now been changed.
Indeed. And boy, that's been a that was a long, long struggle. And the Museum of Moab has these wonderful records. Lloyd Pearson is another guy that's sort of all through this book. He was an archaeologist and a park ranger, and very much a sort of a local historian and very much involved in the life of Moab. And he tried pretty hard to get the name changed. It was originally was the N-word Bill Canyon, and then it was changed to the slightly less offensive version of that word. And a whole lot of people in the town of Moab sort of like, well, he was friends. And the version you always hear is my father knew him, my grandfather knew him. And he didn't mind that word. And he actually asked people to call him that. I question whether anything about that story is true. And if it is true, I think it shows that William Grandstaff was well aware of his isolation, of the demography against him, and was a guy who wasn't going to make waves, because he's not a dumb man and knows what might happen to him if he tried to assert himself.
So this is spectacular lands, all these arches and towers, etc. Tell me how the monument first came to be established, and then the park.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite stories. So there was a Hungarian-born prospector. This guy named Alexander Ringhofer. And the story he tells, and there's slightly different versions, but it seems to be that he was either deer hunting with his sons, or his sons were deer hunting, and they came back and told him that they'd seen these, kind of extraordinary features. So this is the early 1920s. Ringhoffer goes and visits, and pretty quickly he gets to the right people, it seems to me. He writes to, first person he writes to is the passenger agent for the Denver and Rio Grande Railroad. And I don't know how much Ringhoffer knew about other parks, but certainly the railroads are all over the early history of Western national parks. Railroads were in favor of Yellowstone, and Yosemite and Glacier because they're always looking to increase their passenger numbers, their ticket sales. So Ringhoffer writes to Frank Wadley. Frank Wadley comes to the area with a photographer, and he starts contacting people within the Interior Department, within the pretty recently created National Park Service, which had only been around since 1916, says this is a great spot. So there was always a measure of both, I think, quite genuine awe at what they saw at these, extraordinary landscapes, but also self-interest. And I included there were a couple of Ringhoffer letters, but the one I really liked was the one he wrote in, I believe, 1928, where he lays claim to being the discoverer and lays out all of these development plans. He wants to dig wells. He wants to establish mining claims. He wants to build roads. He wants to bring movie directors in there. So Ringhoffer is he's looking to be a, it seems almost a tourism entrepreneur.
Tell me about Frank Beckwith. He's a key figure here.
Yeah, Frank Beckwith's an interesting guy. So he is an editor of a newspaper in Delta, and very much an autodidact, a guy who's just interested in lots and lots of things, perhaps especially geology. And he gets hired, and I'm not quite certain how that process went, why he got chosen, to lead a kind of multi-purpose, small scale, but multi-purpose scientific exploration of the area. The kind of thing that if we go back as far as Lewis and Clark, Thomas Jefferson sends them out to do everything. Talk to the people, look at the geology, determine the resources, all this. So Beckwith does that, and Beckwith is also very much in keeping with the sort of National Park Service ethos of the time, which is, boy, we want to attract people here. We want to make this a desirable tourist destination. So he's talking especially about roads. It's like you got to have good roads.
So 1934, 175 people visited, which is unimaginable to me. And then you later on you say a recent year, I can't remember which year, 1.8 million, 2021, 1.8 million visitors.
And that's just sort of it's an amazing progression. It's not unusual about the Park Service, but certainly the Park Service itself and the private businesses that certainly benefited from visitation and were also involved in this. They were just the obsession about numbers, the obsession to grow visitation numbers is really striking. And in some ways it's still around. People absolutely talk about the value added that that tourism brings to the state, to the town of Moab, to pick a place. But all of the detrimental effects of mass visitation, boy, they're dealing with them in Arches as they are everywhere else.
Another figure you write about is Bates Wilson. long-serving superintendent by that. They were called custodians by this time, superintendent, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. Bates is kind of this amazing figure who's there all the way from 1949, when it's still a barely visited place, to 1972, by which point there's hundreds of thousands of visitors every year. He's the superintendent who carries out Arch's part of Mission 66 to make the parks more accessible, to improve roads, to create visitor centers. Visitor centers are one of the real hallmarks of Mission 66. He's a super important figure. And as I think it's both Stiles and one of Wilson's sons, Tug, talks about, everybody knew the guy, and almost everybody liked the guy. So he was a central figure.
You've mentioned a couple of times, this is chapter 21, Managing the Monuments. So excerpts from the Custodians and Superintendents Reports, 1940s, 1950s. You mentioned roads. That was a big concern of theirs. Weather, projects. I like the prominent visitors. They mentioned in the reports prominent visitors to the park.
Yeah, they always, in these monthly reports, which are just absolutely fascinating to read, and I very much owe Jim Stiles for that as well. It's because I was a regular reader of the Canyon Country Zephyr, his newspaper.
Oh, yes.
And Stiles loved history, loved digging into things. So as he says in one of the excerpts, he spent a lot of time when he was a ranger, especially in the winter when there wasn't anyone around, going through these old reports. And the reports would have, clearly they're in a special format, and you're supposed to include visitation. So they always would note if there's, academics, if there's Dr. So-and-so as a geologist or biologist, film directors, people who are, Alfred Knopf comes down, who was both a publisher and a pretty active environmentalist. So they make sure that they note that. And I think it's inherently interesting in itself, but it's also part of this, hey, we want to increase visitation. We want to increase visibility. We want people to know about these places. And there's a little bit of bureaucratic self-interest. Park Service wants Congress to be aware. People care about these places. Remember that at budget time.
Yeah. One of these, just speaking of that, just one more thing here. One of the superintendents mentioned publicity. The June issue of Utah Magazine contained an excellent write-up on Arches. They're trying to get visitation up.
Yep.
Yeah.
The Times Independent, when it was still a paper newspaper, one of the things I'm struck by as I reread this book is like, wow, that paper does not exist independently anymore. It's now part of the Salt Lake Tribune. They used to run visitation numbers on the masthead all the time. It's like, here's the monthly visitation for Arches. So it really was, almost everybody was sort of on the same page, with the exception of the Ed Abbeys of the world. And Abbey is, he is not a typical person in any way.
Yeah. If you just joined us, you're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest is Jeffrey Nichols. He's a professor at Westminster University and editor of the Arches Reader. And this is a part of the National Park Readers series, talking about Arches on the program today. We'll have more following a brief break. You're listening to Access Utah. Glad to have you with us. Tom Williams here. My guest is Jeffrey Nichols, who's editor of the Arches Reader. This is part of the National Park Readers series. And, of course, we're talking about Arches. Jeffrey Nichols, I wanted to turn to, when we talked just before the break about the early superintendents were trying to get visitation up. Of course, now we're overrun by visitors in Arches. And you write, visitors to the park shape the place and how it's perceived, just as those who work there or write about it. And so one of your pieces, James Swenson, analyzes the iconic Life magazine cover. I think we've all probably seen this, and you have this in the book here. April 1953. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so Joseph Munch is certainly not the, you know, he's not the first person to take a photo of Arches. But he comes to the park, Monument at the time, on assignment from Life magazine, which, as James Swenson notes, is an incredibly widely read magazine of the time. People either subscribe to it or they see it in a dentist's office or something. And Munch takes this photo, which ends up on the cover, and it's part of a illustrating an article that talks about a couple of places in the Southwest, and it just, you know, it Swenson suggests in people's mind, it perhaps establishes this, you know, that's the image of Arches that eventually becomes reproduced everywhere and becomes pretty world famous. And if I can, I just want to a shout out to James, incredibly helpful in creating this, in editing some of the photos and finding photos. And James has done this for a couple of the volumes in this series. So thank you again to James.
Yeah, he's great. Let's talk about Arches. Names have power here. I didn't know this. Apparently, one previous name was Schoolmarm's Bloomers, and you muse that would it be on the Utah license plate if it was still called Schoolmarm's Bloomers?
Yeah, or Cowboys Chaps, or you know, a whole bunch of names that it had. Yeah, I don't know. And there's a theory. It's not mine, but I think I might subscribe to it, because it comes to be called Delicate Arch. And I think it's excuse me, I think it's Frank Beckwith that gives it that name, that lasting name, as it turned out. Because it's called Delicate, I think it makes people worry about it more. Like, well, it must be delicate. Look at it. You could knock it over.
There have been arches that have collapsed, and other features.
There have indeed. Or chunks coming off it. Landscape Arch has had really, really large pieces come off, which fairly recently, so far, don't do anything but make it look just more extraordinary, you know, just sort of thinner. It's, you know, just as long. But yeah, Wall Arch collapsed a few years ago, and there's a poem about that in the Reader.
One of the I don't know, this is a photograph, I guess, the illustrations, it's beautiful, by the way. There's a series, I think it's Delicate Arch here, if I can turn to this quickly enough, where there's circles superimposed upon it. The idea is these are almost impossible geometric dimensions.
Yeah, I believe that's Millie Tibbs' photo, and she calls it, I think, impossible geometries. Yeah, in some ways, she's looking for a new and different artistic approach to one of the most photographed objects on Earth, and I think she definitely succeeds, and that's another. Another photo that James found for the Reader. Certainly, I think a lot of people have the reaction. You see that arch for the first time, you're like, no way, that can't exist, because it seems to be, it's so anomalous where it is. It's by itself. It's on the edge of this deep depression. One of the most common places from which to see it, it's quite easy to frame the LaSalle Mountains behind it. So here are these snow-capped, pointy, volcanic-looking peaks through this ridiculous ring of stone, and it does not disappoint.
Now, perspective matters. One of these photographs is Stephen Trimble's looking up at Delicate Arch. Seems more substantial to me when you look up at it from the angle Stephen took it.
Yes, indeed, it's a big thing. We may call it delicate, and it could collapse tomorrow, I suppose. But it's substantial. Stephen Trimble was also quite helpful in creating this book, and of course he's got his own Capitol Reef reader in this same series.
Now, I guess we shouldn't neglect, and you don't in the book, pitch blend, which is another word for uranium, right? The effect of uranium on this area.
Yeah, it's kind of certainly for the region, enormously, enormously important. Within the park itself, there's a couple of references, and again, Bates Wilson's there for all of this, chasing prospectors out of the park, where literally talk about one day they go out and these are still dirt roads at the time, and someone has driven mining claim stakes into the road, and had to be persuaded that was not legal. And it was I include a chapter from Ray Ringholtz's book Uranium Fever, and Ray Ringholtz worked for the Park Service for a number of years, and she wrote what I think is a really nice classic last chance prospector story about the most famous of all the uranium strikes, Charlie Steen making a $1 million strike at the what he named the Mi Vida in Lisbon Valley, south of Arch, south of Moab.
You chapter 30, you quote three visitors. It's called Visitors on the Trail, 1953, 2008, 2010. So you write, visitors to the park are strongly encouraged to register at trailheads before they hike into rough terrain. And then they leave writings sometimes.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I spent a lot of time in the Arches Archive, the Southwestern Parks Archive, there in Moab, and because it's the government, they save everything, or they try to. So they periodically send a ranger out to check on the registers, make sure there's more paper, all this, and to collect the stuff that people left. So I spent a fair amount of time reading through those, and some of them are really poignant. I include someone who's leaving after I believe 5 years as a ranger. People write poems, they write songs, they complain, they do everything under the sun in these trail registers. So I wanted to include that with this idea of, there's people who live in the park, there's people who work in the park, there's people who visit the park.
I want to just read this one. I think this is probably from the 1953. Protect your park. Don't bust the crust. Stay on the slick rock and in sandy washes, or you're going to hell. And hell is hotter than here, writes this person.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's a super important thing. I think in some ways it's been a really successful sort of public campaign. It's like, hey, this the what they used to call the cryptobiotic soil. I guess what it's just biotic soil now. It's very fragile. It's extremely important. It takes many, many years for it to form. And so stay in washes, stay on rock. It's hard to do with 1.8 million people coming. So in certain places, the fiery furnace, for example. It's pretty beat up.
You also mentioned, another place to go to get visitor reaction is the Arch's official Facebook page, where management gets flamed for, say, the timed entry or whatever they want to say.
Yeah, and I haven't looked at that in a while. I can imagine that as we get into the, well, it's already the busy season. I'm sure it's full of complaints. Park is very, very full. Takes a long time to get through. They have abandoned the timed entry system, which was used for the last couple of years. It was considered a pilot program. As far as I could tell, it was quite a successful program. They have been, I guess, told from higher ups in the Park Service, we're not doing that anymore. And I haven't read a persuasive explanation for why they've given it up. But it's at the point where the Grand County and City of Moab are actually, you know, they're talking about, should we, can we charter a private shuttle service? Can we actually contribute to solving the overcrowding problem? So it's a perennial problem.
Yeah, whenever I visit Moab, it's not often, but whenever I go down there, you know, I look over to my left as I'm heading south, and it's just cars, bumper to bumper. It's like I'm going to Disneyland.
Yeah, you know, there really is, as I said, only the one main road. Parking's pretty limited, even though the roads in Arches aren't that old. They're, you know, 60 years old, 70 years old. They were designed for a certain amount of traffic and a certain size and width of vehicle. And boy, we've got way bigger RVs and vans and everything else going there. So it's crowded. And Americans, this just in, Americans like their cars.
Yeah.
And they like to make their own schedules. They get angry sometimes if they show up and they're told, you know, well, what do you mean there's no parking in there? There must be. And it's an ongoing problem. Again, going through the archives, you can find study after study after study after study going back decades that the Park Service very carefully said, you know, what can we do? Should we build wider roads? Should we build more parking lots? Should we have a shuttle service? Should we limit entry? Should we have a timed entry? I mean, they've gone through this. They've jumped through these hoops a number of times. And sometimes you do the study and sometimes everybody ignores it. They put it on a shelf and that's it.
I want to, we're coming down to just a few minutes left in the program. This one really tickled my fancy. Chapter 38, Arched Entrance, Arches Eyebrows, 1987.
Yeah.
This is correspondent Todd writing for the Stinking Desert Gazette, which was a satirical newspaper. This is a lot of fun. They're writing satirically about, I guess, a plan to take Delicate Arch, move it to the entrance of Moab. I just want to read this. The project involves the insertion of a massive 10-foot eye bolt into the top of the arch, and with the aid of drills and shims, loosening the structure from its natural pedestal. And as with any satire, it is kind of some uncomfortable truth that he's getting at here.
Yeah, I love that piece. Stinking Desert Gazette only existed for a couple of years. I think it's a nice companion to Stiles' piece about the efforts to stabilize Delicate Arch and make sure it didn't topple over. And I talk to students about that story all the time because I think Bates Wilson practiced masterful bureaucratic inaction to kill that pretty silly idea. It's like, oh, well, we'd love to put silicon on Delicate Arch, but, you know, it's we mixed it too long ago and it's spoiled. So we got to wait till next spring, I guess.
Yeah. Chapter 44, I got a kick out of this, but I guess I go for the more of the humorous pieces. David Fila, a picture is worth maybe 25 cents, which is strikes me. But he's getting at kind of a serious point. He mentions that he and his wife both forgot their cameras, and that that's really a good thing. He says both of us distrust the way photos fabricate the illusion of a fixed, unchanging world.
Yeah, and I think I, you know, I'm guilty certainly of carrying around the camera and firing off stuff. Why not experience it through, you know, purely through your own eyes and feet, and do it that way. And yeah, I sort of love how, you know, someone hands him a camera, asks him to take the photo as people do, and he turns it off.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good stuff. But it does seem, you know, some people you can't count it as an experience unless you have a posed photograph.
Exactly. Yeah. I've been to places as disparate as Dachau where that seemed to be the case. Mm-hmm. And that was a little distressing.
Now, the final piece here is Terry Tempest Williams. Her piece there, you say, reminds us what it means to belong to a place. Why did you choose Terry Tempest Williams to close the volume?
Because she's a beautiful writer. She's has been a local very much for years, living in Castle Valley, very much concerned about the area. And I just like the implication that a whole bunch of these people who are represented throughout the reader, they're members of the Coyote Clan, and coyotes are tough and resilient and smart. And they, you know, we've tried to get rid of them for a long time, and they just keep coming back. They're both admirable, but they're also tricksters, and they lie, cheat, and steal. But they're kind of human while being entirely wild.
Well, good place to end the conversation. Much more we could say. You need to read the book. The book is The Arches Reader. It's part of the National Park Readers series. And we've been talking with the editor, who is a professor of history at Westminster University, edited this volume, Jeffrey Nichols. Jeffrey Nichols, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah.